This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
A bit of housekeeping. Pre-signed books will be available in the lobby from Garcia Street Books. Also, for those of you in the El Dorado Hotel, which I understand now is standing room only, please come to the Lensic after the event to get books. Well, good evening, Santa Fe. Buenas tardes a todos ustedes. Bienvenidos. I'm David Barsamian, and welcome to one of the most anticipated events of this or any other year, Noam Chomsky. And backstage, I was joking with Noam. I held up this flyer. It said, sold out, which will be, I think, ammunition for his enemies. But rest assured, Noam Chomsky has never sold out. Thanks to the Lannan Foundation's In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom series, which organized this event. Thanks also to Lannan for enabling alternative radio to digitize our Noam Chomsky audio archive, which now numbers close to 250 recordings. You can go to alternativeradio.org. Thanks, Lannan. I started alternative radio because of Noam Chomsky. I wrote him a letter, he wrote back, we started corresponding. Then after a while, I suggested we do an interview. He said, yes, of course. That was 31 years ago. It's an honor for me to introduce Noam Chomsky, but how to introduce someone who, as they ritually say, needs no introduction? Well, do something different, I thought, like tell a story. There's a parable from the Sufi tradition called The Elephant in the Dark. Sufism, for those of you not familiar with it, is the esoteric inner dimension of Islam. Rumi and others have told this story, and I've added a bit to it. It's called The Elephant in the Dark. Some men, and women perhaps, who've never seen an elephant are blindfolded and are asked to touch different parts of the elephant and identify what they are touching. So one touches an ear and says, it's a fan. Another touches the tail and says confidently, it's got to be a rope. Another touches the tusk and says, well, for sure it's a spear. Another, a leg, says with great confidence, oh, it's a pillar. And on and on and on. And they start bickering among themselves, each adamantly insisting that he was right. Their voices were getting louder and louder. And then along comes a sage who tells them, guys, chill out. This is not in contemporary. I can hardly imagine in the 13th century the sage would say, guys, chill out. But we kind of modernized it a little bit. Let me remove your blindfolds. See, it's an elephant. And they were all flabbergasted. For many of us all over the world, Noam Chomsky is that sage, the Sufi guide, Murshid. Never showboating or grandstanding, but simply laying out what he sees, backed up with a torrent of facts and documentation. He doesn't tell you what to do, but like the Sufis, he teaches by example. The next step is up to you. You have to figure out your path of societal involvement and action. For decades, he's been illuminating the dark crevices of a rapacious economic system and an imperialist foreign policy, and always in a calm, soft voice. And listen for the irony. By any measure, he's led a most extraordinary life. He's a pioneer in the field of linguistics. To call his efforts tireless and his writings prolific are huge understatements. If records are kept for such categories as giving lectures and interviews, writing books and articles, Chomsky would be world champion. At 86, he's still a rebel without a pause. And as they say in Yiddish, a mensch. And yes, here comes that four-letter word. Children, cover your ears. Love. He is deeply loved by many. I've seen it on the faces of people from Porto Alegre to Denver. And it's no wonder, because he's been there for so many, from East Timor to Nicaragua, from Palestine to Colombia. And this evening, he's here for us. Brothers and sisters, please welcome Noam Chomsky.
It's now 70 years since the end of the most horrific war in history. It ended with the use of an ultimate weapon which can bring human history to an end, a day which I happen to remember very well. We've been living under that shadow ever since. 20 years later, two of the leading figures of 20th century intellectual life, Bertrand Russell, Albert Einstein, issued an appeal to the people of the world, calling on them to face a choice that is stark and dreadful and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? They recognized, of course, that war can very quickly turn into terminal nuclear war. In 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists established its famous doomsday clock, setting it 7 minutes to midnight. Midnight is the end. Last January, it was advanced to 3 minutes before midnight. That's a threat level that had not been reached for 30 years at a grim moment to which I'll return. The accompanying explanation invoked the two major threats to human survival, nuclear war, nuclear weapons, and unchecked climate change. The call condemned world leaders who are endangering every person on Earth by failing to perform their most important duty, ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization. The Russell-Einstein appeal differs from the current declaration in two crucial respects. One is that it did not include the threat of environmental catastrophe, which 50 years ago was not sufficiently understood. And secondly, it directly addresses the people of the world, not the political leadership. That difference is of some significance. There's substantial evidence that on climate change, nuclear weapons planning, international policies generally, the population seems much more concerned than the political leadership, who do not regard their most important duty to be ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization, as ample evidence reveals. It's hardly a secret that even in the most free and democratic societies, governments respond only in limited ways to popular will. For the United States, it's well established in academic scholarship that a considerable majority of the population at the lower end of the income wealth scale are effectively disenfranchised. Their views are simply ignored by policymakers. Influence increases slowly as one moves up the scale, and at the very top, which means a fraction of 1%, policy is pretty much determined. That being the case, the attitudes at the top of the ladder are of very great significance. These are revealed dramatically in a poll of CEOs that was released last January at the Davos conference in Switzerland, the conference of masters of the universe, as the business press describes them. By rather ominous coincidence, this was just at the moment when the doomsday clock was advanced to 3 minutes to midnight. The poll revealed that climate change did not merit inclusion among the top 19 risks that concern CEOs. Worse still, at the top of their ranking of perceived risks was regulation. That is the prime method for addressing environmental catastrophe. Their overriding concern was with growth prospects for their companies. That's not surprising. Whatever their individual beliefs, in their institutional role, the CEOs are constrained to adopt policies that are designed to pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity, in the words of the Doomsday Clock Declaration. And given their enormous role in determining state policy, it's less surprising that policy lags behind public opinion on the concerns that moved the clock so close to midnight. The effects are before our eyes every day. So take last Sunday's Wall Street Journal, typical example. There's a week in review section. It features an article entitled, "Fossil Fuels Will Save the World, Really." The lead story in the news section is headlined, "U.S. Producers Ready New Oil Wave." The article glories in the thought of what they call an ocean of oil from U.S. shale, as American energy companies are poised to unleash a further flood while they lead us exuberantly to the precipice. Scientists are well aware that most of the oil must be left in the ground if there's to be some hope for a decent life for our grandchildren, but who cares as long as there are spectacular profits for tomorrow. On international affairs as well, popular opinion diverges significantly from that of the decision-making classes. Among many other examples, a considerable majority in the United States have held that the United Nations, not the U.S., should take the lead in international crises. Such views are so remote from elite opinion that they're barely even articulated publicly. A good part of the reason is the nature of elite opinion. And as often is the case, it's the critical end of the spectrum that's the most informative. So here's an example from a featured article by the former director of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, leading U.S. intellectual journal, rather left liberal in orientation. Here's what she writes. "American contributions to international security, global economic growth, freedom, and human well-being have been so self-evidently unique and have been so clearly directed to others' benefit that Americans have long believed that the U.S. amounts to a different kind of country. Where others push their national interests, the U.S. tries to advance universal principles." Well, comment should be superfluous, but in what's important is that this is what many in so-called enlightened circles actually believe. It's quite an astonishing fact in a free society where information is readily available and the impact on policy is not obscure. Nuclear weapons policy reveals very dramatically how governments and also the domestic concentrations of power that largely dominate governments, how both regard the principle that ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization is their most important duty. When we inquire, we discover that, regrettably, governments have consistently not even considered security of their own populations as a particularly high priority. It's rather enlightening to review the record. I'll begin with some high points, or maybe low points. So let's begin with the early days of the ultimate weapon, at a time when the United States had overwhelming wealth and power, a remarkable security. There was, however, a potential threat. ICBMs with nuclear warheads. There's a standard scholarly review of nuclear policies. It's by McGeorge Bundy. He was the National Security Advisor for Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. He had access to the highest level documents. Quoting him now, he says, "The timely development of ballistic missiles during the Eisenhower administration is one of the best achievements of those 8 years. Yet it is well to begin with a recognition that both the United States and the Soviet Union might be in much less nuclear danger today if these missiles had never been developed." And he then adds a remarkable comment. He says, "I'm aware of no serious contemporary proposal in or out of either government that ballistic missiles should somehow be banned by agreement." In short, there was apparently no thought of trying to prevent the sole serious threat to the United States, the threat of utter destruction. Rather, the institutional imperatives of state power prevailed, much as in the case of the CEOs, for whom the fate of the species is of such little concern that it does not even enter into the ranking of risks. Furthermore, these shocking facts seem to arouse little interest or comment. In fact, I've never seen a reference to them. Could the development of these missiles have been prevented? There might have been opportunities. One suggestive indication is a proposal by Stalin in 1952 offering to allow Germany to be unified with free elections on condition that it not join a hostile military alliance, which was hardly an extreme condition in the light of the history of the preceding half century. Stalin's proposal was taken seriously by the respected political commentator James Warburg, but apart from him, it was ignored or ridiculed. Actually, recent scholarship has just begun to take a different view. The bitterly anti-communist Soviet scholar Adam Ulam at Harvard takes the status of Stalin's proposal to be an unresolved mystery. Washington, he said, wasted little effort in flatly rejecting Moscow's initiative on grounds that were embarrassingly unconvincing, leaving open the basic question: was Stalin genuinely ready to sacrifice the newly created German Democratic Republic, East Germany, on the altar of real democracy, with consequences for world peace and for American security that could have been enormous? Melvin Loeffler, who's one of the most respected Cold War scholars, recently published a review of research in released Soviet archives. He observes that many scholars were surprised to discover, quoting him now, that Lavrenty Beria, the sinister, brutal head of the secret police, proposed that the Kremlin offer the West a deal on the unification and neutralization of Germany, agreeing to sacrifice the East German communist regime to reduce East-West tensions and improve internal political and economic conditions in Russia, opportunities that were squandered in favor of securing German participation in NATO. It's actually a shocking decision that is being relived right now. Under the circumstances of the early 50s, it's not impossible that agreements might have been reached that would have protected the security of the U.S. population from the gravest threat on the horizon. But the option apparently was not even considered, and possible opportunities were dismissed with ridicule, another indication of how slight a role authentic security plays in state policy. And to heighten the extraordinary significance of this failure, it was just at that time that the doomsday clock was moved to 2 minutes to midnight, the closest it has ever been. These events from the early days of the Cold War have considerable resonance right now, right at the borders of Russia and Ukraine, very serious crisis that traces right back to the end of the Cold War. A crucial issue at that time, around 1990, had to do with the fate of NATO, now that the alleged threat of Russian invasion had disappeared. One might have believed that NATO would have dissolved, quite the contrary, expanded radically. Mikhail Gorbachev agreed to allow a unified Germany to join NATO, rather significant concession, but there was a quid pro quo, namely that NATO would not expand 1 inch to the east. That was the phrase that was used in high-level internal discussions referring to East Germany. And NATO at once expanded to East Germany. Gorbachev naturally objected, but he was informed by Washington that these were only verbal commitments and nothing in writing. The kind of unspoken implication is that if you're naive enough to accept a verbal gentleman's agreement with the United States, it's your problem. Clinton came along and expanded NATO to the borders of Russia, and as another leading international relations scholar, John Mearsheimer, recently pointed out in the major establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, he pointed out that the indications that Ukraine might be assimilated into the Western system, possibly even into NATO, could not fail to be threatening to any Russian leader. We need only imagine how the United States would have reacted at the height of Soviet power if the Warsaw Pact had taken over most of this hemisphere and now Mexico were preparing to join the Russian-run military alliance. Last December, the Western-backed Ukrainian parliament voted 303-8 to rescind the policy of non-alignment that had been adopted by the ousted president, and they committed Ukraine, in their words, to deepen cooperation with NATO in order to achieve the criteria required for membership in this organization. The growing crisis concerning Ukraine is no slight threat, and it is an avoidable one by diplomatic steps to guarantee Ukrainian neutrality, steps which regrettably are not being taken. Well, returning to the 1950s, other developments reveal the low priority assigned to authentic security. When Nikita Khrushchev took over after Stalin's death, he recognized that Russia could not compete militarily with the United States, and that if Russia hoped to escape its economic backwardness and the devastating effect of the war, the arms race would have to be reversed. Accordingly, he proposed sharp mutual reductions in offensive weapons. The incoming Kennedy administration considered his offer and rejected it, instead turning to rapid military expansion. The policies are summarized by distinguished international relations scholar, late Kenneth Waltz, pointed out that the Kennedy administration undertook the largest strategic and conventional peacetime military buildup the world has yet seen, even as Khrushchev was trying at once to carry through a major reduction in conventional forces and to follow a strategy of minimum deterrence. And we did so even though the balance of strategic weapons greatly favored the United States. Well, once again, the decision, the U.S. decision, severely harmed national security while enhancing state power. How severely it harmed national security was revealed in 1962 when Khrushchev sent missiles to Cuba. Partially, that was a foolhardy attempt to right the balance. Partially, it was because of the very clear threat of U.S. invasion in the course of a major terrorist campaign that Kennedy was waging against Cuba, kind of erased from our history, but very much alive in real history. Khrushchev's effort to set off what Arthur Schlesinger called the most dangerous moment in history. And what happened then merits clear, careful consideration. No time to go through the details, but it's worth remembering that at the peak moment of the crisis, October 26th and 27th, 1962, Kennedy received a letter from Khrushchev offering to end the crisis peacefully by simultaneous public withdrawal of Russian missiles from Cuba and U.S. missiles from Turkey. These were Jupiter missiles, liquid-propelled, meaning slow to set in motion, which means that they were first-strike weapons, not intended for a deterrent. They were also obsolete weapons. The U.S. had already issued an order to withdraw them because they were being replaced by even more lethal weapons, invulnerable Polaris submarines. So that was Kennedy's choice. Shall we publicly withdraw obsolete missiles from first strike missiles from Turkey on the border of Russia, which are being replaced by even more lethal missiles, or shall we refuse? He refused. His own estimate, subjective estimate of nuclear war at the time, was between a third and a half. That's, in my view, one of the most appalling decisions in history. And even more appalling is that Kennedy is praised for his cool courage in handling the crisis. Well, 10 years later, Henry Kissinger called a nuclear alert. This was in the last days of the 1973 Israel-Arab War. The purpose of the alert was to warn the Russians not to interfere with his delicate diplomatic maneuvers. These were designed to ensure an Israeli victory, but a limited victory so that the U.S. would still be in control of the region unilaterally. And the maneuvers were delicate. We've learned a lot about them from recent declassified sources. The United States and Russia had jointly imposed a ceasefire, but Kissinger secretly informed Israel that they could ignore it. Hence the need for a nuclear alert to frighten the Russians away. Fortunately, they were frightened away. Security of the population was a matter of little concern, as usual. 10 years after that, the Reagan administration launched operations to probe Russian defenses. That meant simulating air and naval attacks against Russia. These actions were undertaken at a very tense moment. Right at that time, Pershing II missiles were being installed in Western Europe. These had a 5 to 10 minute flight time to Moscow, very destructive missiles. Also, Reagan had announced his so-called Star Wars program, which is presented here as if it were defensive, but every strategic analyst on all sides understands that missile defense is a first strike weapon. If missile defense ever worked, which it might not, it could not stop a first strike, but it conceivably might stop a retaliatory strike, which means it's a first strike weapon. and that was being installed at the time. All of this very seriously caused great alarm in Russia, especially with the simulated attacks. That led to a major war scare in 1983. That was the last time that the doomsday clock reached three minutes before midnight, 1984. Newly released Russian archives reveal that the danger was even more severe than historians had previously assumed. There's a recent comprehensive U.S. intelligence study which runs through the evidence now available and concludes, in its words, the war scare was for real. And he concludes that U.S. intelligence underestimated Russian concerns and underestimated the threat of a Russian preventative nuclear strike, which would have been the end. Recently, we've learned that it was even more dangerous than that. In the midst of these world-threatening developments, Russia's early warning systems detected an incoming missile strike from the United States, sending the highest level alert. The officer on duty, the Russian officer on duty, Stanislav Petrov, decided that it was a false alarm, and he did not transmit the warnings, violating protocol. That was the difference between survival and extermination. Russian air defense systems are much less sophisticated than those of the United States. They pretty much rely on radar, which means line of sight detection of incoming missiles. U.S. systems rely on satellites. We can detect them at the point of launch. So the Russian systems are on much more tense alert. Great danger to us, of course. Well, 20 years before that, back in the Cuban Missile Crisis, a Russian submarine commander named Vasily Arkhipov blocked the launching of nuclear-tipped torpedoes, which could have set off a terminal nuclear war. There were three submarines, Russian submarines. The two other commanders had authorized the launch when the three submarines were under attack by U.S. destroyers during the missile crisis. According to the protocol, the agreement of all three was required. Arkhipov refused to agree, yet another sign of how thin is the thread that we grasp for survival. There are chilling estimates about failures of U.S. systems, which, as I mentioned, are surely far more reliable than the Russian ones. There's a recent review in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists of several years of data on U.S. Accidental reports of Soviet military launches by the automated systems aborted by human intervention. Hundreds of these. These are right in those years of the greatest danger. It was 1979 to 1983. The author of the review, Seth Baum, concludes that nuclear war is the black swan we can never see except in that brief moment when it's killing us. We delay eliminating the risk at our own peril. Now is the time to address the threat because now we are still alive. The former commander of STRATCOM, General Lee Butler, recently reviewed his long career as a strategic weapons planner. And he wrote that he had been among the most avid of these keepers of the faith in nuclear weapons. But now it is his burden to declare with all of the conviction I can muster that in my judgment they served us extremely ill. And he outlines the reasons like the ones I've mentioned. And he then raises a haunting question. By what authority do succeeding generations of leaders in the nuclear weapon states usurp the power to dictate the odds of continued life on our planet? Most urgently, why does such breathtaking audacity persist at a moment when we should stand trembling in the face of our folly and united in our commitment to abolish its most deadly manifestations? General Butler went on to conclude that we have so far survived the nuclear age by some combination of skill, luck, and divine intervention, and I suspect the latter in greatest proportion. Looking over the record, one can understand his judgment. Plainly, these are not risks that would be accepted by any sane decision maker. They are being accepted by decision makers who are perfectly sane, just as the devastating risks of environmental catastrophe are being faced with eyes open and ignored by the masters of the universe. All of them are trapped by an institutional logic that is deeply pathological and that must be cured, and quickly, if we are not to put an end to the human race, in Russell and Einstein's words. Thanks.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
You again?
These lights are super bright. Well, what's it like being a Sufi sage?
Pardon?
What's it like being a Sufi sage? A Sufi sage or something.
Sufi.
I promised that I would do something different in introducing him. But you ended that very cheerful talk. Did I miss something? All are trapped by an institutional logic that is deeply pathological and that must be cured, and quickly, if we are not to put an end to the human race. How do we go about doing that?
It's easy. It's all in our hands. In the case of nuclear weapons, actually the answer is known. There are ways to end the threat of nuclear weapons. Furthermore, as many of you know, it's an obligation of the nuclear weapon states to carry out good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons totally. That's Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1970. That's furthermore a legal obligation, as the International Court of Justice ruled some years later, 1996. And those efforts could be carried out. And unfortunately, we're going in the opposite direction. So President Obama has recently announced a $1 trillion program to modernize and upgrade our nuclear weapons capacity, our attack capacity. Other powers are acting more or less similarly. Policies being conducted right now. I mentioned Ukraine, but it's not the only one, that are bringing the global situation to the point where it might lead to a perhaps accidental, perhaps intended nuclear strike. Incidentally, it's been known for many years, decades, that if a power launches a nuclear strike, first strike, it will be destroyed by the effects of the nuclear explosions. So there's no escape. It's nuclear war that between any powers with any capacity will lead to virtual extermination. We know how to end it, but the steps that are being conducted are in the opposite direction. And there have been some potential, unfortunately aborted, efforts to implement steps that would reduce the danger. So one major threat right now has to do with Iran. In the United States, it's commonly claimed by high officials, commentators, and others that Iran is the greatest threat to world peace. kind of interesting to compare this with global opinion. There are polls of global opinion taken by U.S. polling agencies, Gallup poll, a major one. The most recent, about a year ago, did ask people around the world, which country is the greatest threat to world peace? The United States won by a huge margin. Nobody else was even close. The second was Pakistan, which was probably inflated by the Indian vote. Fortunately, Americans are spared knowledge of these facts. The press refused to report them. But they're facts nevertheless. Anyway, here, it's Iran that's the greatest threat to world peace. There's interesting questions that one can ask about just what the threat is. But let's say there's a threat, whatever it may be. Is there a way to end it? Yeah, there are ways to end it. I don't know if you want me to go into it, but
well,
there
we have to kind of stick to the five-minute
lecture.
I won't mention them. Tell them what that's about.
My dictator over here says I shouldn't. But there have been potential steps which have been blocked by the United States. That's unfortunate. Anyway, in the case of nuclear weapons, we know how to end the problem. It's feasible. It's a matter of implementing policies that are understood. And they could be carried out if there were sufficient popular pressure to compel them to be carried out. The populations of the world care about survival. Their leaders typically don't. They care about power. And we can influence those decisions, particularly in countries like this, more free and open societies. With regard to environmental catastrophe, it's not so obvious that there's a solution. There are measures that can be undertaken to mitigate the threats and maybe to overcome them. That's an open question. But again, policy is going in the opposite direction. What I quoted from the Wall Street Journal is unfortunately pretty typical. You read it in the business presses, the business pages of the press across the spectrum. New York Times, Financial Times, others. Plenty of euphoria about how the United States can become the Saudi Arabia of the 21st century. It can achieve energy independence. We can flood the world with oil. All great and wonderful. The price of oil is going down, which is great. It means good for American consumers who can drive more. And all of these marvelous things are simply very straightforwardly driving us towards a precipice which will fall over, which will be extremely harmful, maybe devastating, for generations not very far away, the generation of our grandchildren. Much worse, of course, for the poorer countries, but also here.
Well, Senator Cotton of Arkansas is one of the many intellectual giants in that esteemed legislative body, recently announced that we do have a great deal to fear from Iran because they control Tehran.
I know. That's pretty soon. But you should add that if you read the Washington Post this morning, you'll discover that Senator Cotton, who's got a real pedigree, even graduated from Harvard, is positioning himself to be the future foreign policy specialist of the Republican Party, taking the mantle of McCain and Graham. He has other interesting warnings. I don't know how much he followed his career, but when he was running for Senate in Arkansas, he warned the citizens of Arkansas that the Mexican drug cartels are linked to ISIS, and joined together, they are working to send terrorists across the border into the United States where they can kill citizens of Arkansas. And of course, all of this is the fault of President Obama with leaving a porous border and so on.
If that's true, we should move that clock to 2 minutes to midnight.
Yeah.
Election in Israel. Netanyahu won a third consecutive term, his fourth overall. Haymarket author and Electronic Intifada co-founder Ali Abu Nima says, Netanyahu's good for the Palestinians. Why? Because he's very clear. No Palestinian state, no compromise. Haaretz correspondent Amira Haas sees only cosmetic differences between the two major Israeli parties. And she says that the now moribund two-state solution is actually a 10-state solution. A bunch of Bantustan, she says, inside the West Bank. What's your view on what happened in Israel?
Well, what happened is, one question is how much difference there is between the parties. They're all pretty much on the right. There was a very minor sort of peace party. Meretz got four seats, barely made past the admissions point. There is the Arab party, which is the third largest, but that's pretty much excluded from any coalition just on racist grounds. No coalition will accept the Arab party as an important constituent. But there are some differences. One difference is, if you read Netanyahu's appeal to the electorate, which carried him to victory after rather tepid polling results, it was a combination of outright racism and extreme fear-mongering. So you've probably read in the papers, he warned the electorate that Arab citizens of Israel are being driven to the polls by leftists with support from foreign governments, all in an effort to undermine his policy of defending Israel from, you know, terrorists, so on and so forth. And that combination of fear-mongering and racism does work. It worked in Israel. We're not unfamiliar with it here. And it's a dangerous sign about the nature of Israeli society, which has been drifting very far to the right. And this is a major nuclear weapon state. It's a violent state. It's carried out lots of aggression. It's a direct violation of international law in the occupied territories. That's accepted essentially by the entire world, with the exception of Israel and the United States. And it can be an extremely dangerous... It is already a very dangerous state, can be much more so. As to the Abu Naiman Amir Haas conclusions, I think they're slightly... I don't think they're analyzing the situation quite accurately. It's widely argued, not just by them, across the board, by, you know, Israeli analysts, Palestinians, others, that there are two options. Either a two-state settlement in accord with the overwhelming international consensus, which includes essentially everyone outside the United States and Israel. That's one possibility. And the other possibility is supposed to be what's called a one-state solution. Israel takes over the whole of former Palestine, Jordan to the sea, and then there'll be what in Israel is called a demographic problem. Too many Arabs in a Jewish state. Pretty soon, in fact, maybe a majority. From the Palestinians who and Palestinian supporters, like the one you mentioned, who regard this positively, say, well, then it'll be possible to carry out an anti-apartheid struggle, a civil rights struggle, to call for the rights of Palestinians within this one state. The problem with that analysis is that these are not the two options. The two options are quite different. The second option, one state, is not an option. There is no possibility, reasonable possibility, that Israel will take over the whole territory and face this demographic problem. They don't want it. The second option, alternative to two states, is something quite different. It is what is exactly happening before our eyes. There are policies being implemented daily right before our eyes. We can see them. We can see where they're directed. They've been in motion for almost half a century, and their purpose is clear. What they're doing, the policies take over, first of all, Israel is taking over, has taken over what it calls Jerusalem. That's an area about five times the size of historic Jerusalem. It includes substantial areas of the West Bank, many former Arab villages. It was supposed to be an internationalized territory. Israel's taken it over, and all the parties, except for the very far-out ones, are saying, yes, this is an indivisible permanent capital of Israel. That's one thing. Then if you look at the development programs, which are pretty systematic, very obvious, one of them is developing a corridor extending east of Jerusalem to include a large town. Ma'al Adumim was built mostly during the Clinton years. Its purpose is to subdivide the West Bank, to virtually partition it. The borders of Ma'al Adumim reach virtually to Jericho, which will be left in Palestinian hands. That's right at the border. So there's a corridor extending to the east, pretty much bisecting the West Bank. If you look at the map, there are other corridors to the north, including other new Israeli towns, Ariel, Dumim. They break up the region further. In addition, Israel is taking over, it's committed to taking over everything that's within the so-called separation wall. It's an annexation wall declared illegal by the World Court, by international opinion, but the U.S. continues to support the policies, so it doesn't matter. That's a large part of the arable land that excludes the Palestinians from their farms, orchards, and so on. Furthermore, Israel is systematically taking over the Jordan Valley. That's roughly a third of the West Bank, much of its arable land. Palestinians are being steadily expelled by one or another pretext, sometimes simply thrown out. Jewish settlements are being established, the wells are sunk, and so on. The traditional method for 100 years now of ultimately incorporating some region inside Israel. Well, you look at that pattern, and you can see what's happening. The Israel is carrying out a perfectly reasoned, intelligent program intended to integrate into Israel everything that might be of any value in the West Bank, but to exclude the Palestinian population. The areas that Israel's taking over don't have many Palestinians, and those who are there are being largely expelled. That will leave the Palestinian population in some kind of limbo, not within Israel, no demographic problem, no one state. Palestinians lose everything. That's the live alternative. There is no serious alternative that anyone has made any meaningful case for to think that there could be one state. Unfortunately, this is the assumption that's made across the board, but if you think it through, you can see that it's extremely unlikely. The likely alternative to a two-state settlement is what I just described, the policies that are now being implemented. What could stop them? Actually, one thing. It's in the hands of the United States. As long as the United States officially objects to these policies, so the official U.S. policy says it's unhelpful to peace, but the U.S. continues to support them. It's providing the military, economic, diplomatic support for them, even the ideological support for them, by the way the issues are framed in the United States, which is quite different from the rest of the world. As long as the United States continues to support the policies, there is no reason to expect Israel to withdraw from them, whether it's Netanyahu or Isaac Herzog or anyone else. There are some differences in the policies, the racist extremely alarmist rhetoric of Netanyahu is not shared by others. So there's some differences, but Amir Haas is correct in saying that they're not fundamental differences.
In New Mexico, under U.S. law, Native American and Spanish land grant heirs have lost common lands, and acequia water rights have been separated from the land for commercial use. What hope for the future do you see from traditional peoples continuing to defend the rights of the commons and the shared use of natural resources rather than exploitation for profit?
Well, again, same story. It's up to you. These are decisions that the American population can make in the case of the United States. And of course, as we all know, this has been going on for 500 years, 400 years, ever since the first English settlers came. There's been a steady attack on the Indian nations, driving them out of their lands, exterminating them, expelling them, sending them to reservations. That's American history. There are two fundamental, profound crimes in American history. One is expulsion or extermination of the indigenous population. The other is, of course, slavery, with its impact still remaining. The United States is what's called a settler colonial society. That's an unusual form of imperialism. It's a form of imperialism in which the imperial power, originally England, settles the country that is being taken over, drives out or exterminates the population. That's an extreme form of imperialism. It's true of the what's called the Anglosphere, the countries that sort of extended out of England. It's true of the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, almost. They didn't quite exterminate the indigenous population. Now, that's an unusual form of imperialism. A very, for the indigenous people, a very dangerous one. And yes, they're fighting back and they need support. However, there's another point that ought to be made about preservation of the commons. That's back to climate change. The commons are the environment in which we live. If the commons are privatized, if they're handed over to ExxonMobil and Chevron and so on, we're dead for the reasons that I've just mentioned. We're pretty obvious. If the commons are preserved for the common good, we have a possibility of surviving. If you look around the world, almost everywhere, it's the indigenous populations which are in the lead in trying to protect the commons from destruction by the industrial capitalist powers, primarily China, others. So in Canada, it's the First Nations. In Australia, it's the Aboriginal people. In India, it's the tribal people. All around the world, the countries that have substantial indigenous majorities, populations, have actually taken steps towards trying to preserve the commons. Bolivia, for example, which actually has rights of nature written into its constitution. Ecuador made an interesting effort to keep some of its oil in the ground where it ought to be if the rich countries, the European countries, would pay Ecuador a fraction of the profit that it would have received from marketing the fossil fuels. The rich countries refused, so now they're doing it, also destroying valuable forest. It's a pretty striking fact, which ought to really shame us, that it's the indigenous peoples who have been driven to the margins of survival who are in the lead in trying to protect us from the folly that we are now carrying out, which is very likely to destroy the possibilities of decent survival. That's the most crucial aspect of protecting the commons.
The day after the big climate march in New York in September, the very next day, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund...
The?
Rockefeller Brothers Fund disinvested from fossil fuels. I mean, you can't miss the significance of that, given John D. Rockefeller's background. Yeah. Is this the start of a major movement in terms of divestment from fossil fuel corporations? I was in Portland, Oregon recently, and an activist told me this is one of the hottest issues on campuses from Stanford to Harvard.
MIT, my own campus. It's a hot issue on campuses. And yes, it's important. It's in a way symbolic, but significant. These are some of the steps that can be made to impede the race to the precipice. How important it is, well, like everything else, depends on people like you. Will you do something about it?
I want to talk to you about two ships, one fictional and one real, the Pequod and Moby Dick and the Titanic. I think it was Edward Said, right on this stage, who years ago talked about the monomaniacal urge of Ahab to destroy Moby Dick no matter what and to take the crew down with him. It was of no concern to him. And what do you think about that metaphor that Moby Dick is nature and that Ahab is an out of control kind of capitalism, and that when it comes to the Titanic, the reforms that are offered up by the centers of power are merely cosmetic. They're moving deck chairs on the Titanic. Recycle your cardboard, drive a Prius, and things like that. Sorry to Prius drivers.
Well, like any kind of models and metaphors, there's some point, but some differences. We are not being, I mean, you might say that Hitler was an Ahab, let's say. He was, especially toward the end of the war, he was dedicated to continuing the war, even if Germany was totally destroyed. And it was the fault of the Germans if they didn't succeed in winning the war. Okay, that's Ahab-like, in a way. But in our case, it's somewhat different. It really is institutional logic. It's not a matter of individuals. Those CEOs who voted in the Davos poll, if you ask them personally, maybe they contribute to the Sierra Club. Maybe they're in favor of divestment. Could be. But in their institutional role as managers of major corporations, they have a duty, in fact a requirement, even a legal requirement, to maximize profit and market share and to ignore what economists call externalities, the impact of a transaction on others. That doesn't enter into market calculations. Well, in this case, the externality happens to be the survival of the grandchildren. But they cannot, in their institutional role, attend to that problem because their task is to maximize profit and market share. There's some range of choices, of course, and there's some variation among corporations as to how they operate. But this overwhelming institutional property happens to be lethal in its nature. It cannot continue if we're going to survive. In the case of state power, it's not dissimilar. Quite typically, states, governments, regard their own populations as a major enemy. The Snowden revelations, for example, reveal the extent to which the U.S. government regards the U.S. population as an enemy, which has to be monitored and controlled. Pretext of defending terrorism is very weak. As you may recall, when the Snowden revelations came out, at first it was claimed by the government that over 50 terrorist acts had been prevented by the NSA surveillance. Under inquiry, they reduced it to maybe a dozen or so. Under further inquiry, it was finally reduced to one. One case, someone had sent $8,500 to Somalia. That was the net yield of this massive program, which is a program aimed at the population to ensure their control and obedience. And that's very typical of governments and understandable. The leadership is committed to power, to state power. If you think through the
record of nuclear policy. I sampled it. If you look in detail, it's much worse. But the record is one of an astonishing record of disregard for the safety, welfare of the population, and steps in order to enhance state power. That's the way powerful institutions function. And these things have to be, overcome institutional pathologies is a lot harder than overcoming an individual pathology. In the case of Ahab, you know, you can throw him into the ocean or you submit him to psychoanalysis or institutionalize him. There are remedies. But in the case of institutional pathology, it's far more serious. As for rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, it's not a bad image, but there are some steps being taken that are not insignificant. The development of solar energy, for example, is proceeding. There are major efforts to try to block it, but it's proceeding. Unfortunately, this is not the center of where it's proceeding. The major production of solar panels is in China, and this means sophisticated ones. They're at the cutting edge of advanced technology in solar panel production. It should be here. But some steps are being taken. There are some environmental rules. But by and large, the primary thrust of policy is in the wrong direction.
Years ago, the philosopher John Dewey said politics is the shadow cast on society by big business. How would you evaluate that shadow today in light of Citizens United and McCutcheon versus FEC and other Supreme Court rulings?
Well, Dewey's comment was accurate. It extends way back. Back in the 1950s, somebody will remember, there was a quip, I think maybe it came from C. Wright Mills, I don't remember, which said that the United States is a one-party state, the business party, which has two factions, the Democrats and Republicans. And that was pretty accurate at the time, but it's less accurate today. The United States is still a one-party state, the business party, but there's really only one faction. The Republican Party has pretty much departed from being a functioning parliamentary organization. That's not just my judgment. Very highly respected conservative political analyst, Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, right-wing think tank, pointed out recently, I think accurately, that the Republican Party has become what he called a radical insurgency, no longer committed to parliamentary participation. There's a lot of truth to that. We've seen it pretty dramatically in the last couple of years. We're seeing it right now. Just take a look at the today's newspaper, the description of the House budget, basically the Ryan budget. What does the Ryan budget do? And all kind of sleight of hand, which economists are just mocking about balancing the budget. But what it actually does is undermine Medicare by moving to privatize it, which means it's the one part of the healthcare system that more or less works because it's not privatized. Its inefficiencies and costs are due to the fact that it has to work through the highly inefficient, bureaucratized, privatized system in the United States. So moving to privatize Medicare is saying, let's undermine the one system that more or less works. Cutting back Medicaid under the guise of federalism, repealing the Affordable Care Act, which sends not a wonderful legislation, but nevertheless an improvement, which will send tens of millions of people into the uninsured lists, cutting back food stamps and so on, enriching the wealthy. That's the one policy of the Republican radical insurgency. Do anything you can to enrich the wealthy and powerful and attack the general population. Well, you can't win votes that way. So what's happened is, over the last years, the Republican Party managers have mobilized sectors of the population, which have always been around, but have never been mobilized into a significant political force. One part is Christian evangelicals, a major component of part of the base of the Republican Party today. You see it in the Iowa primaries coming up, but quite generally. Another is nativists, people who are afraid that they are taking our country away from us, which has a basis in fact. The white population is will become a minority pretty soon. And for extreme ultra-nationalists, nativists, this is a crime that can't be tolerated. People who are sectors of the population who are so frightened that they have to carry guns into Starbucks because who knows who will come after them. In fact, there's legislation in Nevada right now being debated to allow guns to be brought into daycare centers. And maybe some of these three-year-olds were trained by ISIS. Who knows? But these are, you know, these are not small parts of the population. It's a very strange country in many ways. That's a large part of the population. People can be mobilized on those issues and not notice that the policies that their leaders are pursuing are attacking them and supporting the super rich and the corporations. Well, that's one. That's one of the former two factions. What's the other faction? It's not Democrats. It's what used to be called moderate Republicans. If you take a look at the Democratic Party programs, there are a few exceptions, like Bernie Sanders and others. But if you take the core of the Democratic Party, Democratic Leadership Council and so on, these are the policies that used to be called moderate Republicans. In fact, somebody like Richard Nixon would be kind of at the left of American politics today. Eisenhower would be off the spectrum. Eisenhower went so far as to say that nobody even sane could think of dismantling New Deal programs, namely the ones that are being dismantled right now. Current Republican programs are efforts to dismantle programs that were initiated under Nixon. The drift to the right during this whole neoliberal period, roughly since Reagan, is pretty extreme. You actually see it pretty strikingly in the public attitudes towards the health programs. The U.S. health system is an international scandal. It has about twice the per capita costs of comparable countries and relatively poor outcomes. Furthermore, the U.S. government spends about as much per capita as comparable countries, but that's a small part of the health costs because it all has to work through the privatized health system, which is inefficient, bureaucratized, and in the hands of tons of bookkeeping, administration, and so on and so forth, and in the hands of institutions which have no interest in health. An insurance company is not dedicated to health. It's dedicated to making money. So not surprisingly, they do things to try to make money. Well, this, if you look back at the, there's an extensive polling record of public attitudes on health care. And for a long period since the Second World War, there have been sometimes considerable majorities. You know, a lot of the polls depend on exactly how the question is asked. But a large part of the population, often a majority, has been in favor of national health care. You go back to the late 1980s, a majority of the population thought that there ought to be a constitutional guarantee for health care, national health care. And in fact, I think it was 40% of the population thought it already was in the Constitution. That's the late 80s. Now, take a look today. When Obama presented his affordable health care program, you'll recall that at the very beginning, part of the program was a public option, allowing people to make the choice of something like Medicare. national health care. At the time, almost two-thirds of the population was in favor of that, but it was dropped without discussion. It never entered the discussion. The United States has a very unusual, maybe unique, law which bars the government from negotiating drug prices. You can negotiate other things, but not drug prices. So, of course, drug prices are way out of sight, much higher than in comparable countries. The population is overwhelmingly opposed to this. There haven't been many polls, but the only ones I've seen show over 80% opposition. And there was never even any attempt to deal with this. The power of the pharmaceutical corporations is so enormous that there wasn't even an effort to try to introduce it into the so-called Obamacare. If you look at the attitudes towards the so-called Obamacare, they've been pretty negative. Most of the population has been opposed, even though for years the population has been strongly in favor of national health care. And this, of course, isn't national health care. Now, some of that opposition is because it didn't go far enough. We don't know how much because the questions aren't asked in polls. But a lot of it is the kind of thing you see reflected in this famous town hall comment where somebody got up and said, keep your hands off my Medicare, you know, that kind of thing. People don't understand what the government is doing and what the private corporations are doing. And the effect is a significant change in expressed attitudes towards the policies. That's a remarkable triumph of propaganda, if you think about it, especially considering how vital health care is to everyone's life.
Well, those numbers have been at zero for quite some time, and there's a light up there that says exit, but I'm going to take a moderator's privilege here and just go on for a minute or two more, if I may. On this, if that's okay with you. Well, on this long journey you've been on, did you ever imagine the kind of crowd you routinely draw or having your books on display at airports?
Well, I actually started giving public talks on these issues much too late, in the early 1960s, early days of the Vietnam War. I started giving talks about the Vietnam War, and as you know, it was talks to
three people,
somebody's living room, or a church with three or four people or something like that. And there was never, none of us who were involved ever had it, could have guessed at the time that a couple of years later there would be a major anti-war movement. But there was. And the same has happened on other issues. And with all of the negative things that have happened over the past years, this neoliberal reaction since the late Carter, primarily the Reagan years, there's also been plenty of progress. Audiences are very different than they were in the past. Concerns are different. Lots of issues that were fighting issues back in the 60s, you could barely discuss them, are now accepted and taken for granted. Women's rights, gay rights. There was no concern for environmental issues in the 60s. Now there's substantial concern. Over the years, there have been periods of extensive popular activism to try to terminate the nuclear weapons lunacy. The general atmosphere of the public has changed a lot, and you know, audiences kind of reflect that. Well, all of this is positive. There's basically two trajectories. There's one trajectory, which the one I've just been describing, which is constructive, positive, offers hope. There's another trajectory, which I talked about, which is going in the opposite direction. And the question is which one will prevail. But again, as I've said several times, and as you all know without my saying it, that's in your hands.
You were just in Argentina and met with some... You were just in Argentina and you met with some activists from the Podemos movement in Spain. What were your impressions?
Well, this was an international conference of activists from around the world, mostly South America, but some from Spain, some from Greece, Syriza, and others. And it reflects some of the positive developments in the world. One of the major positive developments internationally in the past, for a long time, long as you like, has been what has taken place in South America over the past roughly 15 years. South America, for 500 years since the early conquests, had been dominated by foreign powers. The South American countries themselves were, the typical structure was a small, Europeanized, mostly white, elite, extremely wealthy, in a sea of misery and poverty. The elites were oriented towards the outside. They had their second homes in the Riviera. They sent their money to Zurich, you know, and so on. There was very little interaction among the South American countries. The South American countries were the most religious students of the neoliberal policies, structural adjustment policies of the World Bank and the IMF and the Treasury Department. And they were the ones who suffered most, naturally. But in the last 10 or 15 years, they've pulled out of this for the first time. It's a major change in world affairs. South America used to be regarded here as what was called our backyard. They did whatever we told them. We don't pay any attention to them. Now South America's out of control. You take a look at the hemispheric conferences, the United States is isolated. In fact, the primary reason why Obama made some steps towards normalizing relations with Cuba is that the U.S. was utterly isolated on that issue in the whole hemisphere. They were trying to get some kind of arrangements before the Summit of Americas, which is coming up soon. They didn't quite make it. But that's the goal. This is a huge change. And that's why the conference was in South America. But there were participants from particularly Podemos and Syriza. These are in Greece. Europe has been subjected to a program of a kind of a savage economic program, which has seriously undermined European democracy. It's been devastating for the weaker, the peripheral countries. It's beginning to dismantle Europe's major post-Second World War achievement, the social democratic welfare state programs, and I think that's the purpose of the policies. It's economically destructive. These are the policies of austerity under recession. Even the International Monetary Fund says they're crazy from an economic point of view. But they are, they make some sense from the point of view of class war. They're enriching the big banks, they're dismantling social programs and so on. Well, there's a reaction. The reaction was first in Greece, which has suffered most, and the German banks, which are basically responsible for these crises, are reacting in an absolutely savage way to try to prevent Greece from taking steps that might extricate itself from the disaster that's been imposed. Greece is calling for restructuring of its debt, you know, delaying debt payments and so on. This is particularly ironic because Germany, in 1953, was permitted by the European countries to cancel its major debts. That's the basis for German recovery. That's why it's the dynamic center of Europe. Secondly, Germany practically destroyed Greece during the Second World War. Well, put all this together, Greece is now asking for a limited element of what Germany was granted in 1953, and the German, the powers in Germany, the bank, the Bundesbank, are just flatly refusing in a very savage way. Now, they may get away with it in Greece, because Greece is a pretty weak country. Spain is going to be a harder nut to crack. That's a bigger country, a more powerful economy. And in Spain, in the last couple of years, two or three years, a new political party developed, Podemos, which by now is running first in the polls. And it is also a policy, a party dedicated in a pretty pragmatic, sensible way to reversing the austerity programs, sustaining, rebuilding the social economy, the so-called welfare state programs, and moving the country towards constructive development. In Spain as well, the criminals, the ones who caused the crisis, were the banks, the Spanish banks and the German banks. But they want the population to pay. Notice that none of them believe in capitalism. In a capitalist society, say, if I lend money to you, and since I know you, I know it's a risky loan, and I therefore get a lot of interest and I make a lot of money out of it. If at a certain point you can't pay, it's my problem in a capitalist society, but not in the societies in which we live. The problem is your problem and your neighbor's problem. Your neighbors didn't take the debt, but they got to pay for it. That's the way our system works. Radically anti-capitalist. Makes sense on class warfare grounds, but no resemblance to markets or capitalism. And that's what's been going on, but there is a struggle against it. And Podemos, worth keeping an eye on. They have sensible programs, might win the next election, which is coming up soon. And it's not going to be easy for the Brussels bureaucrats and the German banks, northern banks, to crush Spanish initiatives.
One last question. You grew up in the 30s at a time when solidarity meant something. There was mutual support. There was an active labor movement. What is it going to take in 2015 to rekindle that spirit of solidarity?
Well, remember what happened in the 30s. The labor movement was, in fact, in the forefront. It was CIO organizing, sit-down strikes, and so on. They had a sympathetic administration, so the Roosevelt administration was willing to accommodate to some extent, to the pressures developing among the public, labor movement spearheading it, which did lead to the New Deal legislations, which were very beneficial to the population and to the economy. But go back to the 1920s. The labor movement had been destroyed. There was nothing left, practically nothing left of it. One of the leading labor historians, David Montgomery, died recently, has a book
titled
Fall of the House of Labor. And it's about the 1920s. There had been a lively, vibrant, active, pretty radical American labor movement, but it had been crushed by a brutal attack. This is very much a business-run society, and the business classes are highly class-conscious, constantly fighting a class war, have state power supporting them, and they were able to crush and destroy the labor movement. But it revived, and it can revive again, and other popular movements can as well, too. And there's a basis for it. The basis for it is the quite positive changes that have taken place since the 1960s. In many ways, it's a much more civilized society than it was at that time, on many issues. And I think that is a basis for recreating the kind of solidarity, mutual aid, working together, dedication, commitment that is very necessary today. And we can't overlook the fact that we're at a moment of human history which is entirely unique. For the first time in human history, we are at a position where the decisions that we will make will determine whether the species survives. It's not been true in the past. It's very definitely true now. These are not small questions.
It's quite a sobering note. And as we bring this evening to a close, in Hindi, there's a word called seva. It means service. And I can think of no one who has performed more seva, more service for humankind than you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.